Picture this. You're stepping into a modern technical interview. You're gearing up for an AI engineering role, or maybe like a back-end data pipeline position.
High-stakes stuff.
Oh, totally high stakes. Your mind is just buzzing with Python syntax, machine learning model architectures, distributed systems design. You are braced for the heavy technical artillery.
Right. You're ready for the hardest question of your life.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then the interviewer walks in, hands you a dry erase marker, points to a blank whiteboard, and gives you a prompt that sounds, honestly, almost insulting in its simplicity.
I love this part.
They tell you that you have an array of numbers, and your task is just to find the element that appears more than half the time. That's it.
It sounds so deceptively easy, doesn't it?
It really does. So, welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to break down exactly this scenario. We're tackling the classic problem known as leak code 169.
The majority element.
The majority element, yes. We're going to explore the hidden mechanisms of the problem, the common pitfalls candidates face when they're sweating under pressure, and how you can arrive at the optimal solution by, well, fundamentally shifting how you process data.
The beauty of this specific whiteboard challenge and why it's such a staple is that it serves as the ultimate interviewer Trojan horse.
A Trojan horse. How so?
Well, getting the code to run and just spit out the correct number, that is only a tiny fraction of what you're actually being graded on. Interviewers lean on this majority element problem because it functions as like a highly effective behavioral and technical filter.
Oh, interesting. So it's not just about getting the right answer.
Not at all. It forces a candidate to navigate through three very distinct levels of algorithm design. And every time you level up your solution, you're revealing a little bit more about how you handle the fundamental trade-offs between, you know, processing time and memory space.
Okay, so to truly understand the optimal solution we're driving toward, we first have to, like, examine the natural human reflex here. When you're faced with an array of unsorted data, what's the first thing you do?
You count it.
Right. If I hand someone a massive list of numbers and ask which one shows up the most, the brain immediately defaults to a counting mechanism. In Python, which, you know, most folks are using for these ML and data roles, the instinct is to build a dictionary.
Yeah, conceptually a hash map.
Exactly. You iterate through the array item by item. If you haven't seen a number before, you add it to your dictionary and set its count to one.
And if it already exists, you just increment that count.
Yep. The moment any number's count crosses that 50% threshold, boom, you return it. You're done.
And mathematically, I mean, that approach is flawless. It guarantees you will find the correct answer every single time.
Right.
It also highlights a specific type of efficiency. Like, let's look at the time complexity of that hash map approach. Because you're iterating through the input array one by one, and dictionary lookups in Python are generally instant.
Your time complexity is O of N.
Exactly. You only have to look at each individual item in the array a single time to get your answer. In algorithm design, a linear time scan like that is typically considered the gold standard for speed.
I mean, looking at everything once feels as fast as you could possibly hope for. You can't, like, solve a problem about an array without at least reading the array.
Right. You have to look at the data.
But this is where the trap snaps shut. Because think of this approach like standing at a busy polling station with a clipboard. You're tallying every single individual vote as it comes in.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Yeah, so you write down the candidate's name, you add a tally mark, and you keep an active running ledger of every single person who received a vote. But the clipboard is external to the voting process itself. You're building a completely new list just to keep track of the original list.
And that clipboard analogy perfectly illustrates the concept of auxiliary space complexity. The trap your interviewer set has literally nothing to do with time.
It's all about memory.
Entirely about memory. By building that dictionary, you are allocating brand new data structures in your system's RAM. Consider the absolute worst case scenario for this algorithm.
Which would be what?
Imagine an array where the first half of the data consists of completely unique numbers, and the second half is entirely your majority element.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Your dictionary has to create a unique entry for every single one of those distinct numbers before it finally finds the majority. Your clipboard grows in direct proportion to the size of the input.
So that results in an O of N space complexity.
Precisely.
And carrying around all that extra baggage. I mean, it might not seem like a big deal when you're testing your code on an array of 10 numbers on your laptop. But context matters here.
It really does. Especially for the roles you're applying for.
Right. If you're applying for a data-heavy engineering role, you aren't dealing with arrays of 10 numbers. You're building data pipelines that process massive streams of telemetry, or, you know, working with embedded systems where memory is strictly constrained.
Yeah, and if your default instinct for solving a problem involves duplicating the memory footprint of your input, you're going to bottleneck your systems. Or worse, you'll just run out of memory entirely in a production environment.
Which is exactly what the interviewer is waiting to see if you realize.
Yep. They use this first step to see if you recognize the sheer cost of auxiliary space. They'll let you finish explaining your dictionary approach. They'll nod. They'll acknowledge that it works. And then
they drop the constraint.
Exactly. They'll ask, hey, can you find the majority element without using any extra space? They want an O of one space complexity.
You're no longer allowed to build an external dictionary. The clipboard is officially banned.
Banned. Gone. You have to work entirely within the confines of the original array itself.
Okay, so we have to figure out how to use the inherent structure of the data to our advantage. Which brings us to the second major framework candidates usually attempt. The structural shortcut. Sorting. Exactly. We need to step back and look at the mathematical reality of what the word majority actually implies here. The problem statement gives us a hard constraint. The majority element appears strictly more than half the time.
Its count is greater than n divided by 2.
Yes. So let's visualize the geometry of that constraint. Imagine taking your chaotic, unsorted array of numbers and just sorting it in ascending order.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Because the majority element instances make up more than 50% of the entire data set. Clumping them all together through sorting creates a massive, continuous block of identical numbers.
Right, they're all grouped up now.
And the sheer volume of that block guarantees a specific physical placement within the array structure. Because that block is larger than half the array, it absolutely must cross the exact center point.
That's a really cool way to think about it. It simply cannot fit entirely on the left side or entirely on the right side without spilling over the middle.
Exactly. If the majority element happens to be the smallest number, it dominates the entire left half and spills over the median index. If it's the largest number, it dominates the right half and spills backward over the median.
And if it's a mid-range value, it just sits right there in the center.
Yep. Regardless of the actual value of the number, its frequency dictates its position once sorted.
So your code at this stage becomes incredibly concise. You literally just call your language's built-in sort function on the array, and then you return the element sitting at the index of the array's length divided by 2.
It's basically a one-liner.
Yeah, it completely eliminates the need for an external dictionary. You've successfully achieved your O of 1 space complexity, assuming your language sorts the array in place without creating a copy.
Which feels like a brilliant cheat code, until you remember that built-in sorting functions aren't magic. They require processing power.
A lot of it.
Right. Sorting an array usually takes O of n log n time. So wait, here's where it gets really interesting. We are actively making the algorithm significantly slower just to save some memory space.
Yeah.
Is that a trade-off interviewers actually want to see? Why does sorting take so much more time than our original dictionary approach?
Well, the time penalty comes from the fundamental mechanics of sorting algorithms. In your original dictionary approach, you were just reading the numbers. Look at a number, log it, move on.
Super fast.
Right. But sorting requires constant comparison. Under the hood, algorithms like TimSort or QuickSort have to actively ask questions. Like, is this element bigger than the one next to it?
And if yes, swap them.
Yes. And then, is it bigger than the next one? Every single element has to be compared against other elements multiple times to find its correct final position.
Wow, okay.
That recursive process of dividing, comparing, and moving is what pushes your time complexity from a flat, linear O of n up to O of n log n.
So we traded our optimal processing speed for optimal memory space. We slowed the system down, but we threw away the clipboard.
And this is a vital moment in the interview because it demonstrates mathematical intuition. You're proving to the interviewer that you understand the physical properties of the data you're manipulating.
You aren't just memorizing code snippets, you're leveraging the geometric reality of the array.
Exactly. But candidates often stumble here, not because the code is hard, but because they fail to articulate the proof. If an interviewer asks why sorting works, you can't simply say, well, the biggest group ends up in the middle.
Yeah, that sounds a bit too casual. Lacks engineering precision.
Way too casual. You need to confidently explain that because the element's frequency is strictly greater than half the length of the array, the continuous block it forms mathematically must overlap the median index.
It's essentially a variation of the pigeonhole principle.
Yes, you have to own the logic behind the structural shortcut.
But owning the logic only gets you so far. The interviewer is not going to let you stop at the sorting approach, are they?
Oh, definitely not. They watched you trade space for time and then time for space. Now they want to see if you can achieve the Holy Grail.
The ultimate solution.
Yep. They'll look at the whiteboard and ask, can you find the majority element in O of N linear time reading the array only once while strictly maintaining O of one constant space using no external data structures?
Which sounds impossible at first. Standard programming tools kind of fail us at this exact juncture.
They really do. Sorting secured our memory efficiency but destroyed our speed. The hash map secured our speed but bloated our memory.
So to satisfy both constraints simultaneously, we have to entirely abandon the concept of counting items. And we also have to abandon the concept of organizing or sorting the structure.
We must shift our mental model entirely toward the concept of cancellation.
Yes, cancellation. This brings us to the true climax of the problem, a mechanism known as the Boyer-Moore voting algorithm. Reading the code for this the first time feels a bit surreal because it requires almost nothing.
It's shockingly minimal.
Right. You only need to track two simple variables, a current candidate and a running count. You're just holding two tiny placeholders in memory, which perfectly satisfies our O of one space constraint.
But to understand the logic powering those two variables, we need a strong mental model. So picture a massive gymnasium representing our array. Inside this gym, we're going to host a very specific variation of dodgeball.
Okay, dodgeball. I love this.
The players in the gym are divided into teams, and each team represents a different number from our array. And the critical rule of this specific game, the constraint that makes the entire algorithm possible, is that one team, the majority team, has strictly more players than all of the other teams combined.
Right, because the problem guarantees more than half. So let's play out the game. The rules of engagement are simple. When a player from one team meets a player from a completely different team in the center of the gym, they eliminate each other.
Well, they're out.
Both are immediately removed from the court. So a player from Team A runs into a player from Team B. Both are out. Team A meets Team C. Both are out. My question is, how does this chaotic elimination process guarantee we actually find the majority element?
You just have to follow the math of the elimination. Imagine the absolute worst-case scenario for the majority team. Imagine that every single player from every single opposing minority team perfectly coordinates to target and eliminate a member of the majority team.
Okay, so a massive coordinated attack on the big team.
Exactly. But because the problem guarantees that the majority team has more players than the sum total of everyone else, the opposing teams will literally run out of people to throw.
Oh, wow. That makes so much sense.
Yeah. Even if they achieve a one-to-one kill ratio against the majority, the minority teams will be completely eradicated, and the majority team will still have at least one player left standing on the court.
That brings the algorithm's code into crystal clear focus.
Mm-hmm.
We can map the dodgeball game directly to our two variables, the candidate and the count.
Let's walk through it.
So you start iterating through your array from the very first index. Your count variable starts at zero, meaning the gym floor is completely empty. You look at the first number in the array, and you assign it as your current candidate.
That numbers team just sent a player onto the court.
Yep. So your count variable increments to one.
And then as you move to the second number in the array, you face a branching path. If the second number is identical to your current candidate, a teammate has joined them on the court. So your count increments to two.
Makes sense.
However, if the second number is different from your candidate, an opposing player has entered the gym. And according to our rules, they eliminate each other. So your count variable drops back down to zero.
And when the count hits zero, it means the court is entirely empty again. All the players who have interacted so far have completely wiped each other out.
Right. A blank slate.
So the very next number you encounter in the array simply becomes your new candidate, stepping onto the empty court, and the count goes back to one. You just proceed like this, step by step, all the way to the end of the array. Whoever is sitting in the candidate variable when you finish your single pass is your final answer.
Tracing a concrete example makes the elegance of this undeniable. Imagine an array consisting of the numbers 7757517.
Okay, let's trace it.
We start at the first index. 7 is our candidate, count is 1. Next number is another 7, count goes to 2.
Teammate.
Exactly. Next number is a 5, an opponent, count drops to 1. Next number is a 7, count goes back to 2. Next number is a 5, opponent. Count drops to 1. Next number is a 1. Another opponent, count drops to 0.
The court is empty.
The court is empty. And we are at the final number in the array, which is a 7. It becomes the new candidate. Count is 1. The array ends. 7 is our majority element.
It's almost like magic. You never once have to remember how many times you saw a specific number in the past. Like, you do not care that you saw a 5 earlier. You only care about the relative balance of power at the exact moment you are iterating.
You're just maintaining a rolling state of equilibrium.
You process the array in linear O of n time, and you use virtually zero extra memory.
And that is why interviewers consider the Boyer-Moore voting algorithm a pinnacle response for this problem. It flawlessly navigates the time and space constraints.
But, and there's always a but.
Always a but. A savvy interviewer will lay one final trap to see if you actually understand the algorithm, or if you simply memorize the dodgeball trick from a textbook. They want to test your awareness of the foundational premise making the elimination game work.
Because the dodgeball game relies entirely on the strict guarantee that a majority team actually exists.
Yeah, quickly.
What happens if the interviewer gives you an array where no single number appears more than half the time? Like, what if the array is just the numbers 1, 2, and 3?
Without the explicit guarantee of a majority, the algorithm totally falls apart. It produces a false positive. Trace that array of 1, 2, 3.
Okay. Number 1 is the candidate. Count is 1. Number 2 comes along. Count drops to 0. The court is empty.
Right.
Number 3 comes along. It becomes the new candidate. The array ends. The algorithm confidently returns 3 as the answer.
But 3 is obviously not a majority.
No.
It just happened to be the final random survivor to walk onto an empty court.
So without a team big enough to guarantee survival through pure numbers, the elimination process just crowns whoever gets lucky at the very end of the line.
Yeah. If the problem prompt does not explicitly state that a majority element is guaranteed to exist, Boyer-Moore only hands you a potential candidate.
And a potential candidate requires verification.
Absolutely. If that guarantee is missing from your requirements, you are mathematically obligated to perform a second pass. You use the dodgeball elimination during the first pass to find the final survivor.
And then?
Then you reset your loop and iterate through the array one more time, specifically counting only the occurrences of that survivor. If their total count strictly exceeds n divided by 2, you have a true majority. If not, you return a null value or throw an error, depending on the system requirements.
Communicating that specific nuance, that is the dividing line between an average candidate and an exceptional hire.
100%.
When you're standing at that whiteboard writing out the Boyer-Moore logic, you turn to your interviewer and say, hey, I am implementing this cancellation approach specifically because the prompt guarantees a majority element. If we were operating in an environment where that guarantee wasn't absolute, I would append a secondary linear pass to verify the final candidate's frequency.
Because proving you understand the boundaries and limitations of your tools is paramount. Engineering is about building robust, fail-safe systems. Highlighting that false positive risk shows the interviewer that you're actually thinking about edge cases.
You're thinking about data integrity, system stability.
Exactly, rather than just rushing to provide a clever syntax trick.
So we've mapped out a pretty comprehensive evolution of problem solving for LeetCode 169. We started with the deeply intuitive human reflex, building an external hash map. We recognized its flawless linear time efficiency, but we identified its crippling O of N memory footprint.
Understanding why auxiliary space is a massive liability in production data systems.
Right. Then we pivoted to the structural realization of sorting the array. We discarded the external dictionary and leveraged the geometric properties of the dataset itself.
We traded our processing speed, absorbing an O of N log N penalty, just to achieve optimal constant memory, proving our mathematical intuition regarding how data behaves at scale.
And finally, we achieved absolute mastery with the pure cancellation logic of the Boyer-Moore voting algorithm. The dodgeball game stripped away all excess processing fat, delivering the perfect blend of linear time and constant space.
While critically acknowledging the strict environmental constraints that allow the logic to function safely in the first place.
Treating this progression as a reusable blueprint will serve you in virtually any technical scenario. Whether you're interviewing for a data pipeline role, an embedded systems team, or an AI infrastructure position, the communication strategy remains identical.
It really does. Start by vocalizing the naive brute force approach. Outwardly analyze the specific bottlenecks highlighting space or time constraints. Then systematically optimize the solution by leveraging the inherent properties of the data structure.
Companies aren't hiring you simply to regurgitate code they can find in documentation. They're hiring you to untangle ambiguous problems, critically evaluate hardware and software trade-offs, articulate your constraints clearly, and arrive at elegant, stable solutions.
The majority element problem is honestly just the canvas they use to watch your gears turn.
Well said. So as you prepare for your next whiteboard gauntlet, keep the mechanics of that dodgeball gymnasium fresh in your mind. However, true mastery requires testing the flexibility of your mental models. So we want to leave everyone with a variation of this problem to ponder before your next interview.
Oh, this is a good one.
Yeah, think carefully about the math powering the Boyer-Moore elimination. What if the interviewer looks at your perfectly optimized O of 1 space solution, smiles, and changes the fundamental constraint?
The curveball.
The curveball. What if they ask you to find all the elements in the array that appear strictly more than 1/3 of the time?
That's a total game changer. Does the elimination game still function when the threshold shifts like that? Do you need a second candidate variable?
Do opposing players still eliminate each other on a one-to-one basis? Or do the rules of the gym fundamentally change when multiple teams can hold a massive share of the court?
It's definitely something to chew on.
Next time you find yourself staring down a blank whiteboard, remember that it is never just about the code you write. It is entirely about the story you tell regarding how you arrived at that code. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.